Managing microservices in Kubernetes at scale comes with a unique set of challenges, from inconsistent Helm chart configurations to the complexity of maintaining best practices across multiple services. In this episode of Cube FM, we're joined by Colleen Florescu, a DevOps engineer, to discuss a unified Helm chart approach that simplifies microservices management. We'll explore how standardization improves deployments, the trade-offs between flexibility and control, and the role of automation in the documentation and testing. If you're working with Kubernetes and Helm, this conversation offers practical insights into streamlining operations and reducing overhead. This episode of Cube FM is sponsored by LearnK8s, which has been providing Kubernetes trainings to engineers all over the world for almost a decade. Courses are taught in person or online to groups as well as individuals. They are instructor-led and are 60% practical and 40% theoretical. Students have access to materials for the rest of their lives. For more information, check out learnk8s.io. Now, let's get into the episode. Welcome to Cube FM. Thanks so much for joining us today. Before we get into, you know, the core of the episode, just want to address this question. What are three emerging Kubernetes tools that you're keeping an eye on?
So the main things that I'm looking for now, I think there are two that are kind of emerging and one that's already established, but still looking at it. The first one would be Crossplane. The second one would be Carpenter. And the third one is Kida or Keda. So those are the main three things. I can explain why a bit. I see Kubernetes as a platform, not necessarily only as a container orchestration thing, because I think it evolved to that with the support of the community with all of these tools. You can basically do anything you want now. So Crossplane is, to me, empowering the engineers or everyone to manage their own infrastructure in a common language that they're also kind of using. So that's a great thing. For Carpenter, it's a tool that I learned about like last year, and I think it's really cool in solving the problem with the node sizing, to stop having the t-shirt sizing for your nodes, because things are quite dynamic, you know, especially in a microservice architecture where you have a lot of services of different sizes. And yeah, Kida is for autoscaling, and I'm really interested in all the possibilities for autoscaling because applications and businesses are really complex and they have their own use cases. So sometimes CPU or memory is not enough. I think that HPA gives you. So yeah, definitely scaling based on metrics, it's a cool thing to have in mind. So yeah, those would be the three things that I'm looking for.
And what do you do and who do you work for?
I like to describe myself as a platform engineer, not only as a DevOps guy, because I think it suits the best what I'm doing. So basically what I'm doing is like helping companies or my clients to achieve the DevOps practices and to introduce them into their development process so they can increase speed, they can increase reliability and reduce cost. Basically, this is what I'm doing. I like helping people to be better than they were yesterday. So this is my focus. And currently I'm an infrastructure consultant for ThoughtWorks.
How did you get into cloud native?
Oh, that's a funny story. So before doing cloud native and all of this DevOps platform engineering stuff, I was actually an engineer, a programmer. I was working a lot with JavaScript, a full stack engineer, doing a lot of things in Node, React, what was cool back then. And I've got hired on a project that was pretty small. There were like 10 people or something like that. And because we had a tight deadline and the lack of personnel and no one willing to go onto the Docker and Kubernetes and stuff like that, I had to do the transition. So it was kind of a forced one and something that went with, I just go with my head first. And yeah, here we are.
And in that process, and now as well, how do you stay up to date with all the things going on in the Kubernetes and cloud native ecosystem? What resources will help you as you, you know, went headfirst into it? And what are some of the things you still use nowadays to stay up to date?
So to me, the main Kubernetes blog is a thing that I'm subscribed to, and I'm looking for the news with every minor version, every major version that is happening to the environment. So I like to read into what's happening there. And also the way I approach things is that I like to learn from the people around me and from their experience. So I have a lot of DevOps engineers that are, or Kubernetes engineers connected on LinkedIn. That's the main platform that I'm looking into. So this is how I found the LearnK Kubernetes community and page. So that, again, something that I should try to, and I really enjoy looking into things. Yeah, this is mainly the things that I'm watching for. And what's happening to me, I have an approach where I'm kind of get with a problem or with a task at my work. And based on that topic, I start researching the web regarding solutions or tools or plugins or stuff like that that could solve my problem. So it's a hands-on approach. I try to minimize the read the thing to read things that just out of curiosity, because I think that if you don't practice something, it's hard to learn it or to get into the DNA. So yeah, that's my approach.
If you could go back in time and share one career tip with your younger self, what would it be?
Definitely stop context switching that much and set up some time blocks where I practice deep focus, because in this field, it's really easy to get a lot of messages from people that, okay, this is not working. Okay, we have a fire here. Okay, so on, so on, so on. And because I like helping people, I always try to do their lives easier first and after that mine. So, and probably that's why sometimes the progress or the efficiency of my work is not at 100%, it's at 90 or 95. So time blocking and having or practicing deep focus periods is definitely advice that I would give myself.
To take that point a little bit further, since you mentioned, focus, deep focus, have you read anything by Cal Newport?
Funnily enough, that's the book that I read. So it's Deep Work by him. And I did that, I think, 2 years ago. And that changed a bit the way that I'm working now. Whenever I'm, faced with some bigger challenges, I usually do time boxing, and I'm just restricting myself from any sounds or noise from all around, like messages and everything, and that helps me focus a lot.
Yeah, for people that aren't aware, Cal Newport is a programmer and a lecturer in the United States, I believe at MIT, and has written a lot about this topic about, we live in a world that's full of distractions, as you said, notifications, messages, email, phone, et cetera, and it can be very difficult to break away from that. And he explains in the book and or in his research and his work that we suffer from solitude deprivation, that we don't get enough time where we really just get to be alone in our own thoughts. And we don't realize that things don't have to be that way. We just assume that they're always going to be that way. What I do want to ask, though, is that because I very much suffer from context switching. I was also diagnosed with ADHD a few years ago, so it makes it additionally challenging. But one thing is the theory, because when you read or, you listen to Cal Newport talk about these things, you're like, that definitely makes sense. I really agree with it. But putting that into practice, do you have any practical advice? Yeah, time boxing, like I said, the theory sounds great, but do you have any tools, techniques, tips that you would recommend to other folks out there who are interested in doing similar, approaching things in a similar way?
So I'm very self-aware about myself. So that's a skill of mine. So I notice when something goes wrong or when I want to do something, I actually know all the steps to do it. But I think the first thing would be to work using the Pomodoro technique. I think that's fun. You can have like 25 minutes with breaks. That's a good start. I think 25 minutes is great. I think Cal Newport promote like 2 to 4 hours a day or something like that for the focus. And another thing that I did is to reschedule a bit the way I work. So now I'm a morning person where I wake up really early. And because there is nobody working basically at that time, it's easier to be focused on something. You don't have as many distractions. So in the beginning, I was just putting all the things that I want to focus on, my learning, practicing. I was doing that in the morning. And after that, in time, I was able to also work with my schedule and get these time boxes during the day. So those were two things that I would advise everyone to try. Pomodoro is first because it's easy and you have a timer, you have something that alerts you. And then thinking about your schedule and how you can do things. Yeah.
Great. Now, as part of our monthly content discovery, we found these articles about streamlining microservices management, a unified Helm chart approach. So we want to dig into this topic a little bit more with you. Let's start by discussing the challenges of managing microservices in Kubernetes at scale. What specific issues have you encountered when dealing with many services in this environment?
So to start explaining that, or where the root cause I found to be, I think we should talk about the team's architecture that is around all the companies. So from my experience, what I saw is that you either have a central platform team that takes care of all the infrastructure, and you have multiple engineering teams that are using that infrastructure and they are connecting to it, or you have like a dedicated DevOps in each team that is able to take care of the ownership of the resources that that team is using, right? The problem, I think, appeared with the central platform team, where you are not, I mean, you have the team that is actually controlling how the infrastructure looks, create some templates maybe and stuff like that. But while the business scales, then the teams need to do more and more infra, right? So the teams, the engineering teams, they should focus on one thing, on creating the best product that they can, making the most efficient code, doing the best decisions for the product. So the focus is not on running services in Kubernetes or having the best templates. So from there, the problem appears that if you have 20 teams working together or 20 microservices working together, you can get to a point that all of them get to Kubernetes. That's the common point. All of them are running with deployments, with secrets, with config maps. That's, again, a common thing. But the problem is that all of them are written differently. So because the engineer that is empowered to do that does not have necessarily the knowledge to do to imply the best practices. And he doesn't need to do that, actually. He just does it because nobody probably wants to do those things. So you get into a scenario where you have, okay, all the services are running, everything is in Kubernetes, everything is written differently. And when something breaks, something that's not related to the service itself, then someone from the central platform team needs to be there and to sort out what happened and why it happened. And you get to a point where, yeah, as I presented in my article, you need to learn or to speak like 20 languages at once, right? Because everything is different and you need to adapt. And that's also context switching, in my opinion. Even working from service to service, you need to switch the way it was deployed or released or managed, right? So I think that's one of the problems, or the one that I was talking about in my article.
You mentioned inconsistencies and how services are written. How does this focus on code efficiency over Helm template optimization impact the overall management of large-scale Kubernetes deployments?
So I think the main issue with this is time, right? All of these inefficiencies are consuming time, which is valuable time. The idea is simple, or the fundamentals are simple. You want to get your product as fast as possible to the market. You want to get feedback from your customers as fast as possible. Implement that feedback, and the cycle goes on and on and on and on. These inefficiencies are consuming that time and makes everything slower. So that's the main problem. If you don't, you can have the most efficient code, but if it takes like one day or whatever to create a new release and to make it up to for production, you are losing money basically with that. So I think this is how it translates into practice and what's actually happening with this. Because you can look at, okay, it's just code, it's not written that nice, it's configuration language, it's YAML, I have too many spaces, or the indentation, it's not that important. But if you take a deeper look and try to see how this is impacting the way your business goes, you can see that, okay, it just delays you a lot.
To address these challenges, you've proposed a unified Helm chart approach. Can you walk us through the solution and explain how it works in practice?
Sure. So what I thought is, or what I noticed, is that basically in a company with the teams, all the services are kind of using the same resources, the same Kubernetes objects or APIs. All of them are using a deployment or an STS. All of them are using config maps or secrets and so on. And the differences were minor between one and the other. And I thought that, okay, that can be fixed by templating, right? Because also Helm is really good with templating. So I thought that maybe we can do the templating, the whole templating, in a central place. You have all the function definitions or all the methods there. And then the engineers just focus on adding the input variables to those templates so they can get the resources that they require. That was the first idea that I've got. And in practice, that's quite straightforward. It's just creating a chart, a central chart that has all of these templates. And the engineers with their repositories and everything just import the chart. And they don't get into writing the actual YAML templates for the deployments, for, as I said, they are just focusing on introducing the correct values based on the documentation, because that's what they know. They know the values. They know that the service requires two CPU to operate. They know that they need, I don't know, a persistent volume to be attached, so because they are storing some files locally, stuff like that. So I try to minimize the knowledge level to operate in Kubernetes for the engineers, and I think that this was achieved with this solution.
Your solution includes a feature for overriding functionality, which might be a more advanced topic. Why is this important, and how have you implemented it?
I think it is important because there's a fine line between restricting the people and empowering them. Whenever you talk about the central approach, a centralized thing basically is the view of one person, which is me in this case, because I build that. And I don't want that, because at some time that can be restrictive, because in some teams that can be people that, okay, they know Helm, they know YAML, they know how to work with it. They have the power to do that. So I try to be as flexible as possible, but also implying the best practices and imposing some guidelines. And that's why the override functionality appeared there, because I didn't want to be, okay, each time someone needed something from the chart to be added or anything, they just come to me and I would be a bottleneck for everything. If they have the power and the knowledge, they can do it themselves. So that was the part with the override and why I created it. And the way it's working, it's quite simple. Basically, this Helm chart operates or is structured in functions that are defined for each object, each Kubernetes object. You can see that in the GitHub repository. And each of them has a corresponding override function. And this basically creates two dictionaries that are merged with a function, with another function. Yeah, I said function a lot of time, but this is how it's working. And yeah, this is how it's happening. So you have the main template with the de facto guidelines. And on top of that, you can define another dictionary. And at the end, the two of them got merged. And this is how you create the end resource that can have also the input from the central chart and also input from the engineer that operates it.
Documentation is often a significant challenge in software development. How have you addressed this aspect in your unified Helm chart approach?
So what I did for this is I tried to implement something that goes automatic or works by itself. With minimal input from my side. And that's how I managed to find a tool online, which is the Helm Docs by a guy called Norwood DJ, I think. It was something, a find that I did on GitHub. And how this works with the chart, I've introduced a pre-commit hook that runs every time I did a change on my repository. And based on some comments that I was adding to the value files of the chart, it was able to print out some markdown documentation that everyone can read. I would like to say here that this was a really big focus for me, because for people to implement this and to do this change, change is the hardest thing you can do as a human being, right? You are, as an engineer, you are working on your code, you don't want to spend 2 days to refactor something. So that's why this documentation is really important, because I want it to be easy and I want it to be like straightforward. And why I wanted something automatic, because the value files or the definition for this chart gets really big. Each object has its own inputs. So writing it manually in a markdown file would take a lot of time, probably more time than implementing the whole idea. Yeah, this is how I sorted out.
Testing is another crucial aspect of software development. How have you incorporated testing into this unified approach?
Testing was done with a plugin, a Helm plugin, the Helm unit test. And this is, the again, the automatic part where I managed to implement some unit tests in the chart, where after each time I was creating a new template for a different resource, I was also adding these unit tests that were checking the templating, actually, to see that everything works fine, that everything is rendered correctly, and the resource has its required fields based on the API. This is how I did it during the development of the chart. And also, another way to test this, of course, is, yeah, you need some real-time practice, because you couldn't just, okay, I write some templates here, I write my own test, I can leave the developers now to implement this. It might break stuff, especially into a live environment where everything is working. So each time I was adding something or refactoring something, I did some tests myself on a dummy repository where I was just creating some resources. And yeah, that's how I did it against the Kubernetes API, actually.
While this approach seems beneficial, it could potentially limit flexibility for individual teams. How do you address concerns about overstandardization and loss of team autonomy?
So overriding is one of them. And the other part is something that you can see in an article or in a GitHub repository, which is a social skill, is communication, basically. I invited everyone from the beginning to collaborate to this, to join, to tell me what are their needs. So that's why the version that you see on GitHub is really different from the version that I did for my client, because that one is really specific to their business model. There are a lot of automations that are built there based on the feedback from the engineers. So again, DevOps practices, you need to have a feedback loop and to build things, get feedback, refactor, build again, and so on. So communication and constant discussion with your stakeholder, which is the engineer in this case, allows me or the solution to not be limited and over-restrictive with stuff.
A centralized Helm chart could potentially create a single point of failure. How do you mitigate this risk and ensure changes don't negatively impact multiple services simultaneously?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The way I'm managing this is through versioning, basically. Having a versioning system with major releases, minor and patches helps a lot, especially that you can specify for a chart that has a dependency on this one, which version to use or how to get the latest version, because there are all kind of, I'm missing the word in English, the options. Whenever you specify a version, you can take the latest patch, the latest minor, the latest major. So through versioning, I managed to fix this situation. And also another way is through testing, thorough tests on the things that I'm working on the chart, on smaller services. So that would be it. And especially after doing the testing part, a new version got released and everyone is able to collect it and to benefit from it.
Versioning and access control can become complex with a unified Helm chart. How do you manage these aspects, particularly when different services require different versions of the chart?
So having enforced to have a strict version whenever you define the dependency is one way of taking care of the versioning aspect, which is different from different charts, of course. And regarding the access control, at that time, but I think it's actually platform or vendor agnostic, you can have it on GitHub stored, you can have it on GitLab, you can have it on any other private registry. And the access managed, the way I was managing the access was through, I think it was job tokens in GitLab at that time, where every pipeline that got created was able to access this repository and its container registry where the chart was located. So it was able to fetch it. It had the permission. And also for the engineers, they also had access on their local machines to fetch this repository and install it on their machines, again, based on some personal access tokens.
To wrap up, could you summarize the main benefits of this unified Helm chart approach and its potential impact on DevOps or platform teams working with microservices?
Sure. So the main impact that I think I see for the engineers is that they are able to focus only on the code that they are building or the product that they are doing. They don't need to learn any new technology or anything like that. They just need to focus on a template that is existent and to learn how to work with it based on the documentation that we talked previously, right? The second one would be the aspects of best practices and security that can be implemented in this unified Helm chart. And those changes are implemented in only one place and got distributed through all the services through this dependency model that we discussed. And like this, a single DevOps person can serve multiple teams. And you as an employer, you don't need to have multiple people or multiple DevOps in every team to take care of things. This I see as the main benefits. And with all of this, you gain time, basically. You can focus on other important things instead of debugging a tiny small template on a really strange service that you don't know about, because the centralized approach ensures that everything is the same or looks the same.
Since we're talking so much about Helm, you know, in one of the episodes from our first season, we had a guest, Jack O'Toole, and he had written an article titled "Why Helm's Design is Flawed." And he critiques Helm's templating approach for Kubernetes deployments, arguing that Helm's use of templates leads to complex and unreadable YAML configurations, making mm-hmm. them more likely to have errors and difficult to maintain. Mm-hmm. He additionally said that Helm template language lacks awareness of Kubernetes resources and YAML structure, which then results in suboptimal design decisions. He suggests that better alternatives were available at Helm's inception when it got started, and emphasizes the importance of thoroughly evaluating new technologies before adoption, especially those that are relying heavily on templating. Just want to see, what are your thoughts on that? Do you agree, disagree? What do you think?
I totally agreed with what he said, that you can get to a point where everything is so complex and so, not well maintained, to say it like that, where it's really hard to do any changes. And I think this happens with every templating tool or language. You get to a point that's the problem. But those are tools and only tools. It's like a hammer, like a screwdriver. The people is the factor that influences if something goes good or bad, because you can say that a hammer is bad, right? It's a hammer. The way you hit the nails with the hammer can be bad, and that's the people, right? So if you have persons that know some best practices about writing code, writing templates, documenting stuff and things like that, I think you are in a good position. And this is kind of sort out by this idea of mine. It's not an idea of mine, this unified Helm chart. I first heard about it, I think 3 or 4 years from a colleague of mine. So these are not my credits. It's just, I was trying from my article to help people that can be in the same situation. This idea of the centralized place or centralized stuff just helps you sanitize the people that are actually working with the templates. You ensure that the people working with it are actually hired to work with them, have the knowledge to work with them. And like this, you can keep the things in control, right? And you can still have good templates, even if they are complex. If everything is documented, again, as I said, it shouldn't be a problem. There are alternatives. Technologies will evolve. I don't doubt that. So maybe Helm is a thing for now or for the past, but yeah, I'm eager to adapt when I see something better. But yeah, the thing that I want to say is there's a difference between tools and the people that use the tools. And usually the people are the problem, not the actual tools.
You've recently been part of a workation with the Base7 community. Can you tell us more about this concept and how it differs from a regular work week or a vacation?
Workation is a really nice concept that I really love. I think I've been there for the past 2 years with Base7, which is a freelancer community in Cluj-Napoca, my old city. They're doing a lot of things. The main benefit is that you get to work. You are working remotely. It's a difference between work remote and work from home. You are working remotely from usually a very spectacular place in nature. The last one was in the Danube Delta, a really beautiful place and full of nature. And as I said already, the benefit from that is that you change the context, you change the place, you see the things in a different way after you do a break from your usual setup, your desk and everything. So that's a plus. And also you have a lot of activities. Like, I don't know, you go with the boat, with the bike, you do some hiking. Yeah, that's again helping you to clean off your usual routine. And the work part is that you get a lot of freelancers that maybe you don't know or you never speak with. And you put them in the same place, working together. And inevitably, after 1 week, everyone will talk with everyone. You get new ideas about new things. And even if someone is a front-end developer, it can have an idea that fixes that bugging problem that you have for like 2 months just from talking with a person. Because that's a problem with freelancing and remote working. You tend to get away from teams with social interactions. And so this workation stuff is something that fixes that.
Great concept. Really, really like that. And nice for you to mention that front-end developers are also people, have good ideas and things they contribute. So shout out to all the front-end developers out there. No, that sounds like a really cool concept and really does change, you know, how you see things. Being a freelancer, I've been a freelancer for almost 10 years now. You do really notice a difference from one place to another.
Yeah, that's true. And maybe one thing regarding what you mentioned about the front-end developers, I'm a firm believer that if you are able to get rid of the small things that make the difference in our work, we are all doing the same thinking process, right? No matter if you're writing CSS or you're a backend engineer or the database engineer or everything, if you get away the technology and the context in which you are working, we all take the same decisions, the same way of thinking. So yeah, I think that's something that I want to mention. Maybe you put this or you don't put this, but I think it's a really powerful concept that helps you see everyone as everyone is equal, no matter the context, because you are all thinking the same, having the same breakdown maybe. Yeah.
That's great. I think there's a lot to be said for that. Now, what's next for you?
I'm looking for new challenges in the future, trying to see what problems will come in front of me. I think of myself as a problem solver. This is what I enjoy. So that's why I'm doing cloud native, because there are a lot of problems, a lot of complex problems. So yeah, I'm looking for new challenges. And of course, another big part is helping people. I'm also doing some mentorship for someone who wants to be a DevOps or platform engineer. And I want to continue doing that because I think it's important to give back a bit from what you got from others, since I didn't get to this point alone. It's a lot, just a sum of people helping me. So I'm trying to do that as well.
And what's the best way for people to get in touch with you?
I'm really active on LinkedIn. You can find me there. It's Colin Florescu. And also on email, you can get to me. So yeah, if you want to discuss or anything like that, hit me up.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. Keep up the amazing work and hope our paths cross soon in the future. Take care.
Take a part for having me. See ya.